Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Radical Compliance podcast. I'm Matt Kelly, the editor of Radical Compliance. Today, we're going to talk about a recent FCPA enforcement action, or rather, the declination of any FCPA charges, that I think tells compliance officers quite a bit about the compensation clawback policies and clawback exercises that regulators want to see. This case involves Boston Consulting Group, one of the largest management consulting firms in the world, which received a declination letter from the Justice Department in August. Boston Consulting had self-disclosed an incident involving partners in Portugal who had been conspiring with a third-party agent in the African country of Angola in the 2010s to bribe government officials there. The declination letter had lots to say about the punitive measures that Boston Consulting had imposed on those Portuguese partners, and most notably, the firm forced those partners to give up their equity stakes in the firm. To help us understand the significance of what happened here, I'm joined by Judy Krieg. She is a partner in the white collar defense practice at law firm DLA Piper. So, Judy, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Matt. It's great to be here with you.
First, about the actual FCPA offenses in question, I described them when I wrote about them as rather run-of-the-mill. Employees conspiring with agents to use offshore accounts to bribe government officials. We've heard that many times before in FCPA land. Is there anything you'd want to say or add about the offenses themselves?
I agree with you. It's almost textbook red flags and the sort of thing that I think all of the compliance officers that are listening would routinely see. What I thought was really interesting about the declination is that they do mention the role of the particular BCG employees in Portugal, that, you know, you still had the agents and the high commissions and the agents had connections to the government officials, but those Portuguese employees falsified records when people started asking around about them. And in particular, it makes reference to the fact that the employees backdated contracts and they falsified the agent's work product. And I think that was really the nub of what then led to what you call punitive, but I think that the DOJ would call remediation by BCG in respect of those employees.
Well, then let's talk about that, because I am quite interested in the remediation that Boston Consulting undertook. In particular, the firm docked those offending partners their pay. They docked their bonus pay, docked their severance pay, and then even forced them to give up their equity in the firm, which I am sure they had accumulated over years of service and was probably worth quite a bit of change. What should compliance officers take away from all that, especially since the Justice Department has talked quite often about wanting to see compensation clawbacks not just written out and looking nice on paper, but to be exercised? So what are the observations here?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Matt. The DOJ means what they say and what they've been saying for some time. I mean, before coming on this podcast, I sort of went back and took a look at what have been the resolutions at the DOJ since they announced this pilot program. And this is not the first time that there has been a clawback or a withholding of compensation. And I think that the bottom line, the takeaway from this latest declination is that the DOJ means what they say and what they've been saying. So there are two parts to this pilot program, and compliance officers need to remember that the first part of that is that this is part of how the DOJ assesses your compliance program should you ever find yourself in that situation. So part of the reason for doing it is that DOJ expects this to be part of your compliance program. But then obviously the second part of the program is that there can be a reduction in fines, or you can get obviously credit if you actually do exercise the compensation levers at your disposal, both positive and negative, when it comes to incentivizing or disincentivizing compliance behaviors. So I think that that's really the net of all of this, if that makes sense.
I suppose my next question is, clawbacks are supposed to be part of the compliance program. Okay. So how does one draft an effective clawback policy? I assume it's more complicated than you're fired, now give back your stock awards. So what goes into this? Who is involved, whether it's the compliance officer alone, or is it HR? Is it legal? Is it all three? What can you tell us about how to craft an effective policy here?
Well, I think, again, Matt, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's a group effort. So, if you're a compliance officer and you want to know what your role is in this, I think it's really important that you are the person who, I should say, gets the ball rolling if it's not rolling already. Because as you've pointed out, it's not that there's a clawback policy. There needs to be amendments or updates or consideration of all of the different paperwork and documentation that comes along with the various parts of of compensation. As we've seen in BCG, that can mean equity in the form of an equity interest in a partnership. It can be shares. It can be shares or stock, mirror shares or other incentive plans, long-term incentive plans. It can be bonus plans. It can be employment agreements. It can even be salary or bonus criteria. And as we all know, that's not compliance doesn't hold the pen. When it comes to that. So if you think about the different stakeholders that I would suggest compliance officers need to think about partnering up with and working with alongside compliance on this is obviously you've got HR. Depending on your organization and the size and complexity of your organization, you may have some comp and benefits team. You may have a compensation committee of your board of directors. You would likely want your general counsel or some of the legal team to be involved. It may well be that you have unions to deal with, depending on what country you're in or what industry you're in. So you've got a whole host of people that are certainly going to have a stake in the outcome here. You also have to consider, or compliance officers need to consider, what's the mechanism to actually get this done? Again, it's very rare that it would be within the power of a single compliance officer, or even necessarily a single person, to make these necessary changes. You may need a partnership vote. Do you need a shareholder vote? So, it definitely is going to be one of those, it takes a village, efforts. But the point that the DOJ is saying here is that, you need to try. And the DOJ does, emphasize that you should start early. You shouldn't wait until you are actually in the crosshairs of a DOJ investigation. And really think about the earlier that you start, if you can make these changes to the necessary paperwork, you actually make it much easier and cheaper down the road should you find that you need to actually trigger, actually exercise these clauses. But you've also have made a really important point, Matt, which is that if you have it, you need to make sure that you use it. And that was actually emphasized by the DOJ in one of the well, almost half dozen speeches that are on the DOJ's website about, speaking about this. And one of the things that the DOJ has also emphasized in connection with this, the reason for this is not just because it's the right thing to do, but really it comes down to making sure that the shareholders are not the ones who bear the cost, or reducing the cost on the shareholders should there be any wrongdoing. And I think that's a really important perspective for compliance officers to think about as you're thinking about the stakeholders that you want to sort of engage with, and particularly the board of directors. There's a lot of things that resonate with the directors. One of them for sure is looking at your duty to shareholders. And that is how the DOJ has framed this, that corporates have a duty to their shareholders to make sure that the costs of noncompliance don't really fall on their shoulders and that it does fall on the shoulders of the wrongdoers. So I'll stop there rather than just sort of ramble on, but I think that the overall point is that it really is a group effort. But the sooner compliance officers think about who should be in that group and starting to socialize the issue around those various stakeholders, I think the more effective those efforts will be.
This question just popped into my head as I was listening to you. But speaking of stakeholders, I'm wondering if there could be circumstances where potentially shareholders might come after the board in some sort of Delaware derivative litigation, unhappy that the board didn't exercise a clawback or something like that. I'm just kind of trying to game out how sticky and complicated these battles could be if you're not rigorous in these are the clawback policies we have. This is when we do it. And when we say we're going to do it, we follow through. But how ugly and complicated could it be if you don't have that discipline?
Well, I think what we're seeing these days in the US is that, certainly shareholder litigation, whether it's shareholder class action or derivative litigation, is almost a given off the back of any DOJ investigation. But, the question of how ugly could the litigation get around all this is it could get very ugly. And that's not a point that's lost on the DOJ. So let's just take a step back. The pilot program was announced in March of 2023 by Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco and Assistant Attorney General Ken Polite at the ABA meeting. And of course, you can find the actual parameters of the policy of the program on the website. But when Ken Polite, when Assistant Attorney General Polite gave his speech, he used these words, and I highlight these because I think it's really important. This is what he said, quote, "We are not trying to incentivize waste. To the contrary, companies should make an assessment about the potential cost to shareholders and the prospect of success of clawback litigation, given any applicable laws, and weigh it against the value of recoupment and proceed in accordance with their stated corporate policies on executive compensation." I mean, the DOJ perfectly understands that, if you end up, quite frankly, in a situation that you don't want to be in, there's likely to be litigation. And they are not saying that you have to blindly forge into that litigation in order to show to the DOJ that you really are trying to do the right thing. I think it's a pretty candid assessment by the DOJ that companies do need to take into account and weigh the costs and benefits of what shareholder litigation or what litigation would look like in this situation. You've identified, Matt, that it could be shareholder litigation or derivative litigation if you don't put these in place. But again, the cost to shareholders if you try to claw back and end up not having the right language or appropriate language in your compensation documents, you're going to end up in litigation. I also want to point out along that front, SAP had a DPA with the DOJ. I know that sounds a bit of alphabet soup, so let me repeat that.
Sure.
The German software company SAP in January of 2024 entered into a deferred prosecution agreement with the Department of Justice. There you go. Fewer acronyms. But what was interesting is that in that DPA, SAP had withheld bonuses of about $109,000, but they called out in the DPA that SAP was engaged in, quote, substantial litigation over the propriety of withholding those bonuses. At the end of the day, in the balance of the size of that DPA, which involved a company. Involved contracts of over $103 million in profits. $109,000 in bonuses without bonuses, a drop in the bucket. I can almost guarantee you that SAP would have paid more in attorney's fees than $109,000. But they did it, and they got credit for it from the DOJ. Querying whether or not it was credit that was worth it. But at the end of the day, it was part of a DPA. And so the DOJ is not blind to the cost of litigation, but there is a balancing equation here. You can and probably should expect that in many situations, whether you claw back or not, there could be litigation in any event because, these are just areas that are fraught for litigation.
Now that I'm listening to it, that was another question I had in my mind. Is all with all due respect to shareholders being the litigation ones. I mean, there is an executive here, and he or she might be the clawed back, and they're going to haul this in. So I presume then that, to your point about SAP, there's a high degree of likelihood that the executive is going to fight this in court, and this could get drawn out in quite a bit. I mean, is that accurate to say?
Well, again, I hate to sound like a lawyer and say it depends. It does depend. For example, how well written are your policies or your documents on this? And I'll give an example. I saw somewhere in some of the reading that I've done on this. You think about if you are a compliance officer and you're thinking about how to implement this in your company, think about the trigger that you want in that compensation policy to enable your company to withhold rather than claw back, because it's cheaper to withhold than
Yeah.
to claw back, to withhold someone's bonus. And I was thinking about anyone who's ever written an ethics clause in a third-party intermediary contract knows how this works. If you put in there that the trigger is that you've committed bribery, or that you've commit, that you've breached the FCPA, you've got a very high standard to meet before you can actually trigger that, as opposed to we're going to withhold this on suspicion of wrongdoing. Obviously, much easier language on a much more solid legal footing to be able to do what some of these companies have, in fact, done, which is during the course of the investigation, withholding monies that would otherwise be due. And if you do have those documents written properly, or written in a way that fits your situation, you're much less likely to end up in litigation over it. But the simple fact of the matter is, if you do have employees that are involved in wrongdoing and you do take those expected remedial measures, it's been the case for quite some time that if you fire an employee in a country that doesn't have employment at will, and for FCPA matters in particular, you're likely to be looking at a foreign country, the F, of course, standing for foreign. That's always been a risk when you're dealing with FCPA cases, that you could end up with an employee who you terminate based on a U.S. expectation, who may have rights under local country employment laws. So I think that, again, it's just another risk of litigation that is always going to be a relatively fraught situation when you've got a company trying to meet the expectations of the DOJ or a U.S. regulator or law enforcer versus whatever the laws or expectations may be, particularly in foreign countries.
One other detail that popped into my mind was how much is it important that Boston Consulting was a private partnership? And really, the partners, therefore, are part owners of the firm. And is that different than a publicly traded company trying to claw back stock awards, where you could argue that's my property and you gave it to me? So is there a distinction to be appreciated between the private partnership and a publicly traded entity?
I don't think so. I mean, the difference obviously is in the type of documents and the legal mechanisms in order to be able to do that. It can be extremely difficult to amend stock option plans, for example. It can also be extremely difficult to amend, partnership agreements for professional services companies like BCG. So I think it really just comes down to, again, the documentation that you're dealing with, and the reality of whether or not you can actually amend that, and when what the conditions are under which you can. But it's really just two different forms of equity, at the end of the day, in two different types of organizational structure.
Any other final thoughts or advice for compliance officers as they're trying to get their heads around clawback policies and how to build them well?
I think that, again, I would phrase it more broadly than clawback. I mean, come on, let's face it, clawback just sounds ugly, doesn't it? And I think the point is that if you approach this from the standpoint of shareholder value, as the DOJ suggests that you do, and also don't forget the carrot in all of this. I mean, the policy, the pilot program of the DOJ is not the punishment policy. It's compensation, and it's trying to align up incentives in terms of good and bad behavior in compliance. So, the DOJ does expect, and don't forget the carrot, that you're looking to incentivize good behavior, as well as to make sure that you've got these mechanisms to make sure that you have alignment when there isn't great behavior. Hopefully that won't happen, but I would make sure that you're not all doom and gloom on this. But at this point, I think it's pretty well embedded that even if the answer is not a reduction of fines, it is in the DOJ compliance guidance that they will be looking at this as, how are they assessing a particular compliance program. And so I think that, starting to get that ball rolling, using those DOJ documents as your conversation starting point, and see how you can engage with your stakeholders on it is going to be well worth your time in the end. Be patient. These things don't happen quickly, but I think just starting the conversation is really what compliance officers are expected to be doing, and as part and parcel of their role.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have today, Judy, but you covered a ton of ground for us here. We really appreciate your time and your insights. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And again, everybody, that was Judy Krieg, partner at the law firm DLA Piper, talking with us today about compensation clawback policies and how they can figure into the Justice Department's calculations about whether to bring criminal proceedings against a corporation. That is all for this podcast. I'm Matt Kelly, editor of Radical Compliance. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time.